This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Yannick Magnan.
And I'm Luc-Olivier Dumablet.
And what's our topic this week?
Home scanning film strips.
All right. But first, we have some follow-up.
Yes, we do. So I was too excited in the previous episode, because we were back from the hiatus, that I misread my notes, and I did have over the hiatus follow-up. So you may remember that our last episode in July was episode 211, which was me talking about the recent drama in Social Network. And I have two news items that I think is worth discussing, because the first one is about European access to Threads. I had this note from mid-July, more or less confirming that Meta is blocking EU-based user even from accessing Threads from VPN. So a few users were able to get in via VPN and things like that. But guess what? Meta figured out a way to cut it. And in preparation for this week's episode, I even looked at, like, okay, it's an old news, but did it change? And guess what? It didn't. So if you're in the European Union, you still without access to Threads, which is interesting. Question mark. I guess the best way to put it is I was not expecting them to keep that for long, but it seems that right now it's been on for 3 months, and it has been for without European users for the last 3 months. But it didn't mean that they didn't ship updates already. One of the criticism of Threads that was mentioned by a few people, especially compared to other social networks, was that it didn't have any web presence. So in late August, Meta shipped a web app where you can access Threads. Also, you can send links to thread posts to your friends, and your friend can then see them without having to open the app and things like that.
You technically could do that as soon as launch, because I was reverse engineering the API to that on day one. So, I mean, there was a web app. It was very limited. I think it was read-only, not write.
Fair. And even myself, for my limited experience with it, it was kind of, sometimes it would work, sometimes it would just say, oh, go to the app. So I think on that front, they did improve. But you're correct that the web app I'm mentioning is kind of the equivalent to the Instagram web app, where you can post from your desktop or from any web clients, but it's not only a read-only application. Regarding that, I was quite curious, more or less 3 months after launch, or nearly 4 months, because we're about to go in October, was there any noise made about ActivityPub support? And guess what? No noise at the date of recording, which is September 21st. I'm eager to see if any progress, or at least any PR, will be made around ActivityPub support for Threads in 2023. So if you see news events or news regarding that, or even just mention from developers kind of speaking on the download about their work on ActivityPub, like, please send it my way. I'm pretty curious, and because I am torn right now on September 21st, whether I say if it's coming, if we will see something this year, or it's a 2024 update or things like that. I would have been a bit more optimistic a few months ago, but now that it's really radio silence, we shall see.
I'm really hoping they figure it out in time for my Japan trip, because that's where, if my Japan friends have moved off of Twitter, they have gone to Threads, and I don't want to join Threads. I want to reach them from my Japanese Mastodon account. And Japanese instances seem way more friendly to federate with Threads than North American ones. So that should solve my issues, but I'm just waiting for them to press the button. The other thing is, Meta devs have actually commented in public that ActivityPub federation plans have not actually been taken off the table. They're still in the works. They just haven't committed to a public timeline or anything like that. And I think one of the things that is currently one of their concerns is with the user base that Threads has, if they just flip it on overnight, what impact could that have in potentially like swarming smaller instances with giant queues of jobs to run because they suddenly have all of these users that become part of the whole machine. So there is sort of that trying to prepare for that. And
interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess it is nice to hear because it means that they're kind of surprisingly a bit more conscious of the environment they're in, and especially the fact that it is going to be federated, so that it means that they're going to be the biggest since like activity pub service thingy, let's put it this way, it has big consequences. So I won't put too much judgment into those statements, but still the fact that they're not just fuck it, we'll just turn it on and then people will have to deal with it is somewhat surprising coming from Meta/Facebook.
Yeah, there's a public acknowledgement that it is a more complex problem than everyone thinks it is.
That's good. And that it is for my late follow-up.
All right. I have some follow-up for episode 206, which was about Microsoft not catching a break due to their string of bad luck with Xbox. Well, guess what? as part of the FTC lawsuit with Microsoft, it seems that somebody, it's unclear who right now, accidentally uploaded a bunch of documents without redactions. And some of those documents included the Microsoft Xbox product roadmap and the broader strategy up to 2030. So lots of juicy Xbox information has come out in the last few days. And as usual, I would recommend you to go check out friend of the show Digital Foundry's excellent video about it. But I'm going to quickly go over the key points. So before I go into those key points, though, Phil Spencer, head of Xbox, did do some damage control on X/Twitter, saying that the roadmap that was leaked in this is a few years old and may reflect outdated information, and that we should probably wait for the official announcements. And like, yeah, there's some stuff which is still like at the moment these slides were made, they were still in discussions, and it's not clear what option was taken. But some things are pretty clear given the timeline. So Xbox Series S and X body redesigns are in the works for holiday 2024. These are going to feature more efficient chips, but ultimately no real spec bump from what these devices currently are. And interestingly, Series X would be removing the optical drive entirely, which would mean if they'd stop selling the old Series X, there would be no more disk drives in the Xbox family of products. Interestingly, it seems that no price drop is planned, which again, like I assume price drops are probably one of the things that you have the most leverage to introduce late in the game as possible. So maybe they'll change their mind. But this summer, PS5 has been seeing rather aggressive pricing throughout the summer. So it's strange that Xbox is not following suit.
Yeah, I would. The aggressive pricing on PS5 is literally $50 off.
It's a bigger deal internationally than it is in Canada. In Canada, it's pretty meager. In the UK, it's like significant.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. So that is happening. And also, if rumors are to be believed, these Xbox body redesigns would be facing off against both a slim PS5, which would also be digital only, and a PS5 Pro released within the same time frame. So PS5 continuing to push the state of the art as much as possible, whereas Xbox is kind of sticking to their original game plan. And I believe if you go back a few years, one of the interviews with Phil Spencer was like, we're not going to have a mid-generation refresh like we did with Xbox One X, because Xbox Series X is our mid-generation refresh. We just launched it on the same date as the Series S. And it's like, okay, sure.
Really said that? Oh boy.
Yeah, he said that. Boy. So I mean, I'm inclined to believe that there is not like a mid-generation Series X coming, or a Series XX or whatever they call it, Series Z, down the pipe, because they already said that. And of course, this roadmap also seems to imply that that's not coming either. Alongside these redesigns, we'd be seeing a revised controller with a swappable rechargeable battery. I somehow missed that at some point Xbox controllers changed from going AA batteries to an integrated rechargeable battery, kind of like PS4 has been and PS5. This one is going to have a swappable rechargeable battery, which is nice. And it's also going to have a bunch of weird cloud features, very similar to the Stadia controller, where it would be able to pair directly to the cloud instead of having to connect to an intermediate device to lower latency for cloud gaming. So that would be coming in the late spring of 2024. And then we get to the big one, which is the next generation Xbox. People were debating, like, is the plan just to go all in with cloud and to not have a next generation Xbox? No, there's still a hardware story here. But the big push that they want to make is, well, to be honest, the same big push they've been trying to make for the past two generations. And we never actually see it come to light, which is a theme with Microsoft promises about gaming. Their big push is around cloud hybrid gaming, meaning that they would offer developers capabilities in the cloud to enhance their games with. And they've been literally saying that ever since Xbox One. They've been saying, like, oh, we're going to be able to run like super advanced Forza AI in the cloud, and you can still play Forza offline today, and the game is still fine. Now the generative AI is kind of the hot topic. They have a more coherent story about around that, where they're sort of trying to pitch to like big open world game developers, like, you don't actually have to design quests for your game anymore. You can just use generative AI to run it in the cloud, which is a completely shitty proposition. But a lot of game companies are seemingly into that right now because making big open world games is hard. That's kind of what they're pitch is for, like, what the generation is going to be defined by. And to a certain degree, I think Microsoft doesn't want to get caught missing the next gaming paradigm, so they're trying to lead it. I'm not convinced this is it, but whatever. Other juicy bits from the next generation Xbox. So this is not finalized, so it's one of those things that is up for change, possibly in the years since this document was written, but an ARM64 architecture change was under discussion for this new next generation Xbox. But as pointed out on the Digital Foundry podcast, no one other than Apple really makes ARM SoCs that really even come close to competing with PC gaming hardware. So it's not clear where they would be getting an ARM64 system on a chip that could actually do this. I'm inclined to believe that they would probably just be sticking to AMD for this. Unless NVIDIA pulls a 64-bit processor out of their ass, I don't know where it's coming from. And the other thing is, the graphics roadmap is kind of a disappointment if you're coming from a PC gaming background, because whereas traditionally consoles have tried to push sort of what the state of the art of graphics is, now it just seems like they're trying to catch up to PC gaming hardware. A lot of the graphics roadmap just looks like catching up on the last 5 years of graphics features more than anything actually interesting, which is kind of disappointing. And that means that ultimately, if you just look at this next generation Xbox, a lot of the sentiment around it from people who have been analyzing what the pitch is has been disappointment. And that's not what Xbox needs right now.
Oh, no.
So that is my whirlwind tour of the leak information. As I said earlier, definitely go listen to the Digital Foundry podcast if you want to get the whole details. Alex and Ollie were on that episode, and they are very insightful because they spend all day playing around with PC gaming hardware and all of that stuff. And they have very good perspective on this stuff, while also appreciating that there are console gamers out there who just want to play on consoles, and that's okay. And that's it for me.
Good. So let's move into the main topic. This week, I will be talking, because Unix doesn't do any of that, but I'll be talking about how I now have started to scan my own film strip. And it's kind of it is a direct follow-up of episode 207, which was my last follow-up episode, but it was one of the elements I've said I was preparing the way for. As I mentioned, and just to give you a small recap, there was two reasons why I started to do that. The first one was because I have started to do my own development at home, mainly because from a gift from Yannick's dad, where he gave me a shit ton of black and white film that I can bulk roll myself, which means I can put the film into the canister, and then now that I can develop it, I don't need to go to the lab. The benefit of bulk rolling for me is I can make small cans, meaning that if I want a 18 or 12 or 24 exposure on the film and I have less film in the can so I can swap it out faster, I can do that. So for this week, I won't be talking about development because I want to have a really dedicated episode for that down the road, but I'll be talking about steps that are closer to what I've been discussing in the past, which is literally post-processing. As I mentioned, since I started to shoot film, I was mainly using digital scans from the lab, but those two have, I would say, two downsides. There's a big one, and then there's a maybe less big one, and I'll start with this one, which is the justification why I am scanning myself. So the first one is, for sure, for either black and white negative film or color negative, you, after development, you end up with the film strip that doesn't show the real color. So for black and white, everything that is white is black and black and white. Whereas for color negative, if you may recall, the film strip itself has a orange tint to it that is coming from the strip itself, and then all the colors are just weird. So you have to go through an inverting process, and I'll use the word inverting lightly because I think the best way to describe it is, in the late 90s and early 2000s, there was algorithms built to figure out, like, oh, if this color is this tint, it means that, and things like that. And all of those algorithms were based on the way you would take your film of strip, your film strip, expose it to light again, and ensure that you do like darkroom development with real paper to make a real positive out of your negative. So all of that has to happen again, and the easiest option for this to happen is to go to your lab where they might already be developing. If I speak for the places I know in Montreal, most of them either offer just development, just scanning, or what they call dev and scan for development and scanning. And again, the fees might vary between if you bring them the film yourself, if it's already cut, or if you want different file size resolution or file image resolution, which will for sure crop the size. So, as you can imagine, if I start talking about the price, it means that one reason why home scanning is good consideration for somebody that shoots somewhat. I'm not a big shooter of film, but still, if you start to shoot a lot of rolls during the year, you can save a quite good amount of money. And for sure, you'll need the upfront investment on that, like everything with gear, but we'll discuss that later. But just to give you a perspective, with Canadian prices again, I've seen places ranging from maybe, let's say, half to, like, from 40 to 50% of the price that you would pay at the lab is dedicated to the scanning operation. So the best example I can give you, one of the labs I go to, it's $20. And out of this $20, $10 is for developing, and the other $10 is for scanning. You might feel it's a bit expensive, but again, the lab I go to, they charge extra if you want to have TIFF files, and they even could charge even more just for scanning if you wanted to have higher resolution scans. So you can imagine that every roll will cost more money if you cannot do development yourself, which is not something I do, let's say, for color negative, for example. So costs can add up pretty quickly. I think the other benefit, or the other reason why you would like to do film scanning yourself, is being more involved in the process of photography. Again, like I mentioned in the introduction about scanning, a negative, it is somebody, a computer somewhere is, or somebody wrote program in a computer to interpret the color that the sensor sees from an image of a negative. So there is a creative aspect to your post-processing. And also, the scanning person at the lab also will tweak your color. And the best way to see that is, let's say you would develop a roll of film, and it's, let's say, Kodak Porter 400, just for the sake of conversation. And you don't cut it, so you have a higher chance to not pay too much extras when you go put it at the lab. But you could take this roll and go in 2-3 different labs, and you would end up with colors in your image that are slightly different or even quite different, because after the roll goes through your typical scanning equipment at the lab person has the opportunity to do the cropping, to get rid of the borders, and also tweak the color. And that's where they might decide, they might make a creative decision already in this post-processing step of applying different colors. So by using software yourself, or being closer to the stage, where you get an image of the film negative, and then you apply your own conversion algorithm, and then tweak the sliders like you would do in normal digital post-processing, you are in control of those early stages before you receive either TIFFs or big JPEGs.
Okay, so I'm going to interrupt you here and ask the question that is probably on all of our listeners' mind, which is if you had trouble with post-processing digital photos before, why is this appealing to you now that you're doing it in film, which just adds more steps?
All that thought.
Okay.
We'll end up in the process section when we talk about software itself. But for sure, the main thing I can say right now is, again, a bit about cost. The one thing I've seen is, for sure, is right now, if I wanted to use this roll that I received from it, that is 100 feet, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would have paid the same $20 to possibly, it would have forced myself to make big rolls myself, so 36 exposure, to ensure that the money I spent at the lab for their development time, their development chemicals, and the time of the scanning person, the scanning assistant or lab assistant using the scanning machine, paying for their time. I want the most exposure on those self bulk roll loads. Rolls. So it means that if I wanted to do that, I would have to always ensure that I have the most number of exposure on those roles. Whereas if I do that myself, I can be a bit more flexible on that without having to pay the full price of what the lab would charge.
Yeah, I'm not debating that part. I think that makes perfect sense. I'm just, there's, yeah.
Don't worry. I know I've discussed that I am not the biggest fan of all digital post-processing and things like that. But I guess what I can start to say, it's, there's good and bad, but I think it's changing my opinion a bit. So we'll discuss that more. Uh-huh. But yeah, those are the two reasons why I've decided to do that. Again, yes, a bit more control into that. It is interesting because I think the best example is I am currently starting to... I have scanned more black and white film than color film. And right now, even on the color side, I have scanned more slide film than color negative film, just because of what I have shot in the recent weeks. And even this week, I've dropped 2 rolls of film at a lab, and it's a new lab I want to try. So I also said, I'm going to pay for the scans, even if I will possibly scan them again to practice my scanning techniques.
You just want to know what the results are like.
Yeah, and a good advice I've learned recently, I was listening to a photo podcast. Yes, it was. It was a photo podcast, a film photography podcast, and it was two dudes interviewing somebody else as a guest speaker. And the woman was explaining her creative journey when she does that. And one of the questions came is like, oh, do you scan yourself? Or like I think she was even curious what the two O's were doing compared to what she was doing. And one thing that was interesting on her mention was like, I know I go through the lab myself. I found a lab, again, to go back to one of the points, one of the whys, I found a lab that gave me scans in the way that I know when I put them in Lightroom or any post-processing application, I have the flexibility to play with the colors and things like that the way she liked. And one advice she had for more beginner people, which I didn't consider, but I think she's totally right, is that you should get used to the film look and the film colors a lab give you before trying to do that yourself.
Yeah.
So you know what it looks like, because we'll see later on when we talk about software, it's not easy even if there's software that helps you do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's far from easy. Good. Now that we've discussed the why, we'll discuss the gear, because you need gear. So we're not skipping the gear part. I know, I'm sure you are like zero surprised that to do that you needed to buy gear, and yeah. So, a few months ago, I think it was in March, there was a company that I started to follow part of this film photography journey. It's called Veloy. It's a different brand from Camera Store with a K, which is a store in Finland. But they have a couple of brands regarding this kind of one business in the UK about, and in Finland, excuse me, about kind of film photography. But they have the Camera Store. They also have like a repair center, and they also make a lot of different film photography related equipment. Like with the Veloy brand, which is a lot of scanning gear. Because at its base, if you do scanning the way I do it, we discuss you can go to the lab. They have dedicated like lab scanner equipment that I've entered in the past. But again, as a normal person, unless you're ultra rich, you cannot really buy those machines, because guess what? They're no longer made, and in all the labs that are still open, they want one. Or I think they might still be open, but like hard to get for sure. As a non-business person. So the three options at this point is there are consumer-ish or prosumer dedicated film scanner. There are optimized flatbed scanners that allows you to also do film scanning. And there is digital camera based scanning, or you might have heard the term DSLR scanning, because even if we move to mirrorless, people still call mirrorless DSLR just because they mean the digital thing. The digital one. And the place I decided to go is with digital camera based scanning, because for me, I think it offers two benefits. Is I am not planning to stop shooting digital. And at the same time, I end up with a camera that can be used for scanning purposes. So you can do double duty. All the workflows, all the digital needs can be handled with this camera, which also can then also do all the work to scan those films. So if you use a flatbed scanner, I don't think you need to explain what a flatbed scanner is, but it's a flatbed scanner. One particularity is that the one I've seen, I think if you do a couple of search, you'll hear a lot about the Epson V700. Oh, I think there's the V600, the 700, and the 800, something like that. But I'm pretty sure about the V700. And if you look at the flatbed part, so it looks pretty normal, but the door that closes on top of it is stickier, because you'll see that there's a big strip in the middle where there is another light that is shining from it. So you put a film holder, because one important thing is if you want to scan film, it needs to lay flat on a surface. Like on this flatbed scanner, it needs to lay flat on it to ensure you have a proper focus on the film scan. The film strip itself. There are other scanners, the more dedicated one, that they also have older, or they, you give it a strip of at most 6 exposure and then it is able to do scanning. But overall, those functionality, from what I've seen, is they require a lot of setup, and then you can just press scan and then move away. But move away for 45, 50 minutes. Like, I've seen that it can take, for scanning up to 6 images in one strip, it can take up to 30 minutes for sure, from what I've seen in tutorials and videos from others. So it's a few settings to ensure that the scanner scans. Like with the flatbed, you can always highlight an area that it will focus and then just do an image for you. The same thing applies for flatbed scanning of film strips. But it is not a fast process. And my understanding is it can give you good high resolution results at the end of this. But it takes a lot of time. Then we come up with digital camera scanning. Again, the cameras in the past 20 years, their sensor technologies have improved greatly. You can have a small camera with 40, 50. Like, these days we're ranging between 25 to 50 megapixel in resolution. Whether you're APS-C, full frame, or even if you're in the medium format, like 50 is the bare minimum in medium format. So all of this is to say is you can get pretty high resolution imaging sensor. But to expose them correctly, or to allow them to capture film, you need a few equipment. I think the typical setup in the past few years that has been is you would buy or use a copy stand that you have, where you would put your camera on the pole, pointing down to the base of the copy stand. And then on the copy stand, you would have a small equipment that would hold your film strip. And below this holder, you will have a light that would shine through it. And again, like with any scanners, it's important that the strip lays flat. In March, I've backed one of the Valoy product, this one is geared more to, I think it's kind of an enthusiast pro, like it's in the mix of the way they were selling it. It's your first digital camera scanning equipment you'll get. So it's a bunch of metal tubes that attach at the end of a lens. And at the end of this, you have a film strip holder and a light all in one small box. And the one benefit of that is because it is attached to the lens, you don't have to calibrate and ensure that both the sensor plane is parallel to the film holder, and making sure that there's no angle, that everybody's well like aligned and everything, to ensure that when the camera is trying to focus, because the depth of field and at this distance, because the distance is pretty small, is utterly tiny. So even just a few millimeters of curvature in your negative means that you might not have an image in focus. The last element I haven't mentioned just yet is the lens you use. It is important to use a good quality lens, but the most important part, it is a macro lens that gives you, for sure, if you can, closer to one-to-one reproduction size, which means that if you have a 35 millimeter frame on your negative, it will be more or less 35 millimeter frame on your full frame sensor, you use the 1.6 or 1.6-ish reproduction size ratio if you're like me, currently using an APS-C body.
So currently the idea, using an APS-C body. Interesting choice of words there.
That was made unconscious, but no, there is, I guess now I have to say, there's currently no full frame bodies in my possession. So,
it's the canary statement you're going to leave on your website until it's no longer true.
Fair. But no, the first usage of currently was unconscious until you mentioned it. So that was pretty funny. But yes. So it means if we put go back, if you were using a more traditional digital camera base scanning setup, you would have a copy stand. On the base of the copy stand, you would have a light and a good quality light that goes, that gives you good color reproduction. Then on top of that, you will have your film holder, and then pointing directly parallel to it, the sensor parallel to that base with the lens pointing at 90 degrees down, you would have your macro lens a few centimeter away from it, because again, at that point, from the, like when I was doing that, I think it was maybe 20 centimeter, not even, the, from the start of the lens to the film holder. It's super, super short distances.
If you're having trouble visualizing this as a listener of the podcast, I would greatly recommend that you go find a video of this in action, because when Nukrivi originally explained it to me, I had no idea what the fuck he was talking about. And then I saw a video and I was like, oh, this makes perfect sense.
Yes, and I will... Not to mention, you can go on YouTube like Nick said, but I'll put a link to the Bear Valoy dot, I think it's valoy.co website, but also put a link of the their new product that I'm currently using, which is called the Easy 35. Because the main difference is, if you think about it, like I said, the depth of field is so shallow at those distances that just like a 2 millimeters where your whole copy stand is not level correctly could end up with a not in focus image, which means that it's usually a lot of people do, they buy a copy stand, or they have a copy stand, they set it up, and then the only thing they do is literally leave the height setting at the same one. So you want one that gives you precise height control. So if you give just a small twist on the lock, it just goes up or down a few millimeters at a time, and you just leave it there. And I've seen people just leave their camera body there, and it's like they turn the camera body off, they turn the light off on the holder, and then they go away. They just disappear. The Easy 35 is literally a big filter. I think imagine if a lens filter is like 20 centimeter thick, because their thinking is to make that more, that might make that simpler. They give you aluminum rings that use the filter threads on your lens. So you screw them in, and then at the end of it, you end up with this box. So it's easy to find, okay, I need 1, 2, 3. Okay. According to this lens, I should be at 3 rings. And they have for sure different length of rings. And at the end, you screw on this adapter. And again, link on the show notes to have an image while I'm describing it. But the same logic, right? Is you want the sensor to be parallel with this. And the easiest way to have the sensor and the film strip to be parallel is to be attached to the lens. So the other thing is you don't need to be mindful that your copy stand moves, because it's not any movement could cause any issues with this. It's attached to the lens. You can literally shake the lens if you want while it's taking photo, and because they're all attached into one thing, like there's no camera shake or camera movement or little, again, it's not recommended that you shake it in the air, don't get me wrong, but still, because they're all attached together, like you could take a photo at like one, like half a second if you want, because it's all attached together, and again, it's a bit simpler to get it right the first time. Like the best example I have right now, and let me pick it up, is I have two of the big rings. Yes, two of the big rings and one. No, just two of the big filter adapters. And I just remove it from the macro lens. I put it back when I need, and then I just have to tweak the focus just a bit. But I know where it is. There's no like mirror alignment using levels and things like that. It just works. So one benefit of those setup. And again, you can spend varied amount of money on that setup. I think what the product I have right now is pretty neat. One of its downsides, and we'll talk about this later, is it's only for 35 millimeter film. You cannot do medium format with it, which is a different problem. But that's one of the downsides. So that's why I say it's more of an enthusiast product, because their first product that the Valoy company does is was really atypical, where you have a light holder, a film strip holder, and then it is, you can buy their copy stand, or it is assumed you provide the copy stand. Another known company, I think more here in the North America, I think it's a US-based company, I'm not sure, but it's called Negative Supply. So you might be able to find their equipment here more readily available. You might have like a camera store that have some of their equipment. From what I've seen here in Montreal, nobody is really keeping this type of equipment in stock, but Downtown Camera in Toronto is having Negative Supply equipment, because I know a friend just bought some recently. But a few people are building that. Or you can just wing it. I've seen people on like Instagram, on YouTube, they just put a box, a paper box or a cardboard box, they put the light below, they use a tripod, and it works. Like, I don't have a coffee stand, and the few moments where I was using that type of setup is I just invert my tripod head for it to point down, and it does the same thing. For sure, it's hard to have finer adjustment of the height of the camera, but there's a way to make do. There's always a way to make do. And I think what is important here is to have a good quality micro lens. And I would say a real micro lens or older film-based micro lens. I know some of the Nikons I was looking at, they don't do one-to-one reproduction. You might have to have extension too, but it is still like the macro lens you install, it's still considered a macro lens, just that it needs extension tube. So don't put extension tube on a normal lens to make it act like a macro is the recommendation I've seen during my research. Is you really want a macro lens. And yeah, if that macro lens require extension tube for a better reproduction size or reproduction ratio, follow the manufacturer's recommendation, but don't try to make a non-macro less macro using extension tube. The results might not be to your liking. Okay, now that we have the gear, oh, and I didn't mention it, but hopefully you have a digital camera to do that. I was kind of forgetting about the obvious, but my assumption is if we're talking about digital camera base scanning, is you have a digital body to use. I've seen a lot of different recommendation on resolution depending on the film type and size. Again, I use a lot of the Valoy content, their guides to introduce you to scanning, but in the general consensus, I've seen that for 35mm, they suggest that you do have at least 8 to 10 megapixels from your camera. But they suggest to be closer to 15 to 20 if you want to get the most out of your film negative, and give or take double it, so around 40 to 50 if you're shooting medium format. Same thing with the base minimum, where they say yeah, around 20 you can make do, but if you want the most resolution out of your negative, they suggest to be more closer to the more recent high megapixel camera. So it depends. A lot of the recommendation is to use either an old DSLR or an old mirrorless, because they do have a lot of nice functionality. And in this case, for example, you don't need to care that your old mirror or your first gen mirrorless is slow to focus. It is nice because the mirrorless can give you like focus peaking, for example, so to show you with coloring on the LCD, on the screen, with which area is in focus. So for sure, it's really way easier to do that with the screen than with an eyepiece. Or I'm doing that with my DSLR, and let me tell you, using live view on my old Nikon DSLR, it works. It's just that I've seen why people say never use the live view on an old DSLR. It literally destroys the battery. I never seen so low battery life on my DSLR, and let me remind you, I've been rocking one battery on this DSLR for the last 10 years, and it was never a problem up until I started to use live view in the recent years for digital shooting and also for scanning purposes. okay, now that you have the setup, you start to pull your fill and then your film, and then at each frame you take a photo, blah blah blah. I'm not going too much into the the specific details, because they vary mainly on the type of light you use. But the gist of it is you put your lens at f8. Usually that's where the lens is the most sharp. The idea is you want to have all your frame in focus. Hopefully the frame you shot on the film is in focus too. But at least you know that the camera is on focus, on focusing on something and not in focus. Then that's a different problem you have to fix. But you see what I mean. And usually if you have a good light, like I've seen that at f8 at the lowest ISO, and that's super important, go to the lowest ISO that is natively supported from your camera, not of the ISO simulation. Like I know on my Nikon it's 100 the minimum, and then if I go below 100 it says low, a third of a stop, low, two thirds of a stop. Like those are simulations. So you want to stick to a native ISO for your sensor, because the inversion process or the conversion process from a negative, from an image and a negative, will bring out noise in your sensor. So it's really important that you shoot at low ISO. And to give you an example, shooting at 100 f8 with the light I use at full brightness, I still am able to get like 1/250th of a second, like 1/200th of a second. So you still can get fast speed, but if you need to have slow speed, you just either use a remote or just put it on the table, press, and then left, like be, use a timer functionality, and then just don't move, not to introduce any blur. For sure, if you use something like the EZ35 like I am, that's a bit easier. But for sure, if you use a copy stand, any vibration in your house could cause vibration on the copy stand. So that's something to take note of. At 1/200th of a second, no problem for sure, but something to keep an eye on. Okay, so you spend literally 5 minutes, because if you go look at videos, when they stop talking like I am right now, and then they just show you the process when they're set up, it's literally like you push the film, click, push the film, click. So even at 36 exposure, it is quite fast to go through a roll. But then you don't end up with positive, you're still with just image of the negative. So you need software to do the conversion for you. And this has been a journey. That's where we'll be talking about my journey into post-processing. It's not a nice one. I'll start with this. I'll talk about the few options. And I think they go back to where I left things off. I think my process right now is not perfect, but it has stabilized. In preparation for this, so I was just looking at my notes. I was talking, oh, I might be exploring Capture One. I might even exploring Lightroom Classic. In the last 3 months, that did not happen. I'm like, I have photos. Either they're not processed or they're processed. And guess what? I'm using my flow that I've described in episode 207, which is they end up in Lightroom CC. I do all the post-processing in Lightroom CC. And then I bake JPEG. And then they end up in Apple Photo. And that hasn't changed since I came up with this workflow in the last 6 months. The thing that has changed is when I get with scans, they go in through an intermediate wrap, and it's not mine because I'm not talking about EXIF data this week. It is an app that will do this conversion for me. There are one main, like if you right now, like go on Google, put me on pause for 3 seconds after what I'm about to say, and just search how to scan film at home, or how to do the post-processing after scanning. You'll end up quickly hearing two things: use Lightroom Classic and use Negative Lab Pro, which is the recommended plugin for more or less doing that. It's been out for years, is my understanding. It seems to be one of the best ones, but as we discussed, I don't want to use Lightroom Classic. And what one app I've seen a lot more recently is called Film Lab. And this app is dedicated. It's an app, not the nicest app. It's kind of a web app, sadly. So,
oh, no.
Yeah, it is a native app because it's available on Mac, Windows, iOS, iPadOS, and Android. So it's a cross-platform application. And I think it uses React Native from what I've read about it. But it does one thing and one thing only. Remember, I mentioned that, okay, Lightroom CC has benefits and downsides, and I'm dealing with those right now as much as I can. But slowly but surely, I kind of want to get back in a place where I would like to do things on the phone or on the iPad. Not there yet because Lightroom on iPad is missing feature, but I've kind of put that project on pause. And that's what drew me to this app is like, okay, it's a dedicated app, so I could do all of what I need to do in this app, end up with TIFF file at the end, import them, and then we're back literally to normal post-processing, like if I receive TIFF files from the lab. But yeah, film negative conversion is not easy. Even if you have an app like FilmLab that gives you sliders and things like that, it's still an interpretation of those colors, like I mentioned. So you kind of need to look to know what to... Either you need to know already the look you want to have and kind of bake it in the TIFF files that you produce with this app, or you do like a bit like... People call it like a flat scan. It kind of reminds me like... of the videographers when they shoot in log, right? It's kind of a flat image, like everything is gray because like there's no highlights, there's no shadow. But then you put this file into Lightroom or any post-processing app, and that's why you play with the shadows and things like that. So trying to find this balance can be hard. And right now I'm using FilmLab because, again, I don't want to go to Lightroom CC, but this app is a bit more limited in the tooling it can give you. So the best way to describe it is I put the SD card in the computer, I put the file on disk, they go into my drive where this one is being backed up, to kind of give you a wink about our previous discussion about backing up shit, and then I keep those raw files. Again, shoot raw, right? You don't want to shoot JPEG from for your camera. You shoot raw, it processes the raw correctly, and then literally you open one file in the app and it tells you, oh, this is camera color positive. So assuming like I show you the image as is from the sensor, maybe a bit of color processing for slide film, but my understanding is more or less basically showing you the raw file as is. And then you can change the type of image that it is and say color negative, and then boom, it does its processing. You have a few sliders for exposure, contrast, things like that. Also white balance and things. But overall, it applies its algorithm. And from my experience, from what I've seen from the labs versus the cover, sometimes it's doing spot on, sometimes it's a bit off. And in their defense, it is what I'm describing is in version 2. They've already announced version 3. And they have a beta for it out. It's full of bugs. It's a beta. But their color algorithm is like way better. So I'm really eager for version 3 to be fully out and have those bugs fixed. But again, like to say, the issue is sometimes after it does its processing, even with the option it gives you, it's really bare bones. It's more, again, like an enthusiast app. And I know that's how they describe it in the Valoid scanning guides. It's kind of like more the enthusiast. Because, again, Negative Lab Pro is like I said, a Lightroom. It's a plugin for Lightroom Classic and has access to a lot of the powerfulness that is Lightroom. Because it's literally taking your raw and applying its own. My understanding, I didn't look at, I don't think I call this public either, but like from what I've seen and a lot of the way people describe it and the way it acts in Lightroom Classic, it literally applies a preset that is its processing of your conversion. So, and again, when you do that, there's way more option to tell it how you want it to process. So it can even simulate like well-known professional scanner. So you might have heard of the Frontier scanner or the Neritsu scanner. It has presets for those. And it's able to tell you, oh, I want a more cinematic look or I want a more flat scan. So you're able to apply this and even do color correction right away. And then once it does the conversion, you're in the middle of Lightroom. Right, so you have all the powerful aspect of Lightroom, so that's why you will hear about this plugin a lot. last mention about another alternative for the software itself is called Analog Toolbox, and this is for Capture One and only for the Mac version. It seems to be, I'll put the link in the show notes for this one too. It seems to be kind of somebody that is kind of building a plugin themselves. It was kind of the same thing about Film Lab. Like, the guy was like, hey, I'm kind of wanting to do that, and then literally build the business around it. I think for Analog Toolbox, it's still kind of a more of an RB project. And also, it's kind of like you give it, you say, apply the color negative conversion, couple of tweaks, but not that much more settings. So the pro mode is really negative lab pro, with the main downside that you have to fucking use Lightroom Classic.
It does feel, though, that if you were trying to build an indie software business, that film photographers are a great market because they already have to spend a lot of money for their hobby. So you know that they're comfortable with spending lots of money. And you have a bunch of people who don't necessarily want to use Lightroom Classic. So you can just build alternatives to that.
Right, and it's interesting because Negative Lab Pro as a plugin is, I think, $99 USD, flat fee. So, and so the developer has to keep it up to date with Lightroom Classic, which is now still, even if it's classic, it's a subscription service. So it has to keep up with all the Lightroom updates and things like that. Whereas Film Lab is a subscription app. You either pay per year, and their lifetime price, I think, is the price for 2 years or 3 years. I think it was no, it's a bit more than that, because I think my subscription was 60 USD, and then the full price or the lifetime is 200, so give or take in the 2 to 3 year range of paying. So it, yes, it's a subscription, people are bitching about that, but I'll have a link in the show notes for this app, and go look, because on their website they've made a YouTube live of when they announced the version 3 beta, and they describe about a lot of their thinking and a lot of the work they've done to tweak their algorithm, and they even spoke with image processing engineers that built scanners. They even spoke with engineers that were dedicated on the chemistry that is use in dark rooms, so that they're trying to make their algorithm not just an inversion of color, but makes the algorithm react the same way that, or close enough to the way the chemistry in the dark room reacts and the paper reacts to this exposure from a negative to become a positive. So that was pretty interesting. If you want to nerd out, I'm not like, I always say that I went to university to hear about like computer science problems that I never used day in, day out. And it was fun to hear just on the surface, like image processing. It's like, oh yeah, I kind of remember that people were saying at university, oh yeah, this theory is good for if you do image processing and things like that. But yeah, I still enjoy what it gives me. So again, you put the files, you do a few tweaks, and then you end up with TIFF. And then the rest just happens, because we're back to where I used to be. I have TIFF files, and then I just put them in Lightroom, and I do, okay, I want to boost my shadows, or I want to literally crush my blacks, so everything is contrasty, especially for black and white, things like that. All I can do that in Lightroom, or if I want and skip a bit of that step, I can try to get that out of Film Lab. Sometimes I'm able, sometimes it's a bit harder for me, so I have to go do it. And that part is pretty interesting, because the last thing I want to talk about those two is the reason why I said that I'm happy that I'm doing that, because I feel that's like, it goes back into what I like so much about film is being more involved. It's a more involved process, and it's fun to do this more involved process is my general consensus about why I like it so much. I guess I'm kind of saying I like to suffer, because it's harder than just click, 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 and voila.
Yeah, you're reminding me of the people I'm running into in the Linux community, where it's like, you can install this one Linux distribution and all the problems are taken care of you, or else you can do it the really hard way and spend like 5 hours doing like 75 steps, and it might not work at the end, but just because you did all the 75 steps, like, you feel like you had a more wholesome experience than if it actually just worked out of the box.
Exactly, and I think that part applies to home scanning too. There's always a risk that you fuck up. And you know what? In the end, currently, I'm not really too happy about the results I get. I've scanned a few of the color negatives that were already processed, and it's a weird mix in the end. Again, I have a friend that is starting to be in film, and he has an eye resolution digital body and also literally a latest Sigma macro lens. And I was like, but what I'm trying to see here is one of the downsides I've seen from the scans I receive, and I've been going through in the past few months more or less the same place, but I went to another place before. That's also why I'm trying this other place. But in the labs around here, if I don't want to mail in my photos or my rolls to somebody, they end up having like their middle range scanning option is more or less 3,000 pixels by 2,000 pixels, which gives you, give or take, 7 to 9 megapixels, which is fine. But another place I wanted to go more deeply is, yes, I've started to have a small printer to print 4x6, but I really want, and that's something I mentioned in the past, I really want to print bigger format, put it at home. Like really, and when I say bigger format, 10-15 is maybe the max, or 11-14, like those bigger sizes. Like I'm not talking about like a billboard and things like that, but things that I know my Nikon D500, when I take digital photos, is plenty. Like it's 12 megapixel. I know those bigger sizes at 300 DPI might not be best, but it's be like plenty comfortable to do those sizes. So 7 to 9 megapixel, A, for bigger sizes, feasible. You might end up with bigger pixel, but still, like, and it's more into the comfortable zone for 8 to 10 than those bigger sizes. So that's one of the reasons why I would say, oh yes, I have a quote unquote higher megapixel body, so I can do that. But one thing that I guess has disappointed me for sure is that if I scan it myself, the sharpness is not the same. I think even if I have lower megapixels files, the resolving power of those scanners is still something. But I've seen with higher megapixel bodies that you can make it happen, you know? So that's where I am at the end of this process is, for black and white, I can, you know what, with black and white, I'm making do with it. It's fine. But for color, I'm a bit more disappointed to, I guess, what a lot of people were saying. I've seen a lot of results on the web, but it's kind of saying, okay, maybe the reason I think those results look great is because I've seen it in a video, I see it on Instagram, but then when I'm pixel peeping in Lightroom,
yeah,
that's where it falls down a bit. And you know what? Maybe my problem, I should not be pixel peeping, but that's then the nerd in me that says, oh yeah, I have image A and then I have image B. What are the difference between image A and B? Right? I've been paid a lot of money at work to do that for UX. So that side of me was talking about. So that's where I end up right now. I enjoy the process, but especially for color negative, it frustrates me a lot because tweaking the color is still something I need to be better at. And B, I still feel that I think it's the resolving power of that, of my body. I think it's my body, but right now I feel where my setup falls down is the resolving power. Yes, I end up with bigger files, but then if a small details looks blurrier because it's not resolved enough from the negative, like we're still back to square one. So I had that result, like I kind of discovered that in the past few weeks when I was doing this prep. I've received one of my Vaqueros. I shot a slide film, and I was like, this one, I don't want to see the scans from a negative. Like, I will do it myself. I just wait for the lab to process it. Don't cut it. Return me just like the big roll, develop, but not scanned. And I see these, but I'm like kind of like powering through it. I'm teasing those photos. I'm sure they'll end up on Instagram. Yannick, I've seen some. They look great. But again, if you pixel peep, I feel that certain details, I'm like, oh yeah, it's kind of weird. but we shall see. Taking that all aside, I don't think I'll stop doing it, but it is putting more pressure on spending money on gear, which then kind of erases the why we are doing ohm scanning ourselves.
I thought the reason we had hobbies was to justify spending money on gear.
Yes. I shouldn't say yes, but yes. Yes. But yeah. Which is funny because to end the section on scanning, I have a few general photo updates I want to discuss, which you'll like because they're about gear too.
Of course.
Is literally that. Is that... Give me 3 sec. Okay, yes. I literally lost my train of thought.
Uh-huh. Do you need me to remind you what you bought in the last few months?
All that thought. That's what I'm... Okay, no. So, to come back to what I was saying about the resolving power, I've seen one of my colleagues using his 24 megapixel full frame body, and I was like, okay. So, it means that I will currently continue using my D500, but it is really in the back of my mind, what do I do with my digital body? Which slowly transition into the general updates. So, over the summer, I was, I don't say lucky enough, but I had the opportunity to attend two events where a camera manufacturer associated himself with a local shop, and they're like, we bring our gear, come try it. So in those two events, one was from Fujifilm and one was from Nikon. So I had the opportunity to try four bodies. At the Fujifilm event, I was able to try the X-T5 and the X-H2. And at the Nikon event, I was able to try the Z7-2 and the Z8. And I was a bit not surprised that I liked both Fuji bodies. But I was a bit surprised that the Nikon body didn't vibe really with me. I think it's generally speaking that they look like DSLRs, and they're great cameras. Don't get me wrong, they're great. Even the Z8 is a great camera, but like I think right now in the Nikon lineup of Z cameras, I don't feel there is quote unquote anything that fancy me, right? But putting that aside, I've been thinking in the past few weeks of like, what was my output on digital bodies for the last year? Sadly enough, not that much stuff.
I'm not surprised.
I've attended a few events where, yes, I use digital bodies and things like that, but a majority of my output has been on film. And if I buy a film like a digital body, maybe I should start to weigh more the fact that it will be used as a scanner and less as a digital body, but still hold a place of the backup. Like, you want to experiment cheaply, digital cameras are the greatest thing on earth for this, especially when you love shooting film, because every time you click, it doesn't cost you money.
You want to experiment cheaply, so you buy a $3,000 camera.
All that thought. But on that point, I think that's my recurring frustration with the digital camera market is... nothing is cheap. And I don't want to go back to this because I've been bitching about this for the last 2 years.
Yep.
But yeah, so that's where I'm stuck is I love the X-T5. I was presently surprised about liking the X-H2, which is more traditional like SLR style bodies with the PASM dials and which with scroll wheels and things like that. And not having the X-T5, which is more like you have something for ISO. You have a gear. You have... okay, I'm blanking on the words again, but you have a button for ISO, you have, not buttons, but wheels. Thank you. So you have a wheel for the ISO, you have a wheel for the shutter speed, you have the aperture ring on your lens. Like, it's really tactile. I thought this was more my jam, but I was lately surprised by a more traditional digital body format like the X-H2. Yannick is trying to, or... I shouldn't say Yannick, but Yannick is always saying he should come on the Sony world. I'm sure that
I feel
also...
like I haven't said that for a while, but...
fair. That's what I was saying. You kind of said that, but also I kind of put myself in a decision where I'm saying that to myself too. But I digress. But yeah. So to kind of conclude this general update related to scanning, I will continue to scan myself, especially for my black and white needs. I want to continue exploring what my color needs, because I feel I'm in the zone where if I stop, it's because I feel uncomfortable about my skills, and I think I should continue to do so that I improve my skills, how to use the post-processing software. I know the software is going to be improved, like FilmLab app. I'm sure even these days I'm getting better at using, just getting better in the vibe of post-processing at Lightroom too, even if I do basic edits. But it's getting better and faster also. And then in the past few weeks, I'm getting good at like processing. I don't think, like right now, I think I have two roles that needs development time. Like I haven't developed them. Those two are black and white. And then I am in the process of metadata tagging the slide film. Most of the color processing and the reframing, the resizing has been done. And there's another one that I need to do a few adjustments before I export. So overall, I'm about maybe 100 photo late, which is a rare thing for me, which means I've been pretty due diligent of processing my things, which means it means doing the post-processing. So I couldn't believe I said that. Hopefully, we'll stay like this, but I'm being pretty good at doing that. Okay. That concludes the scanning section. Did you have any other question? I know we're kind of like right now kind of walking on the line between my two sections, but I think now it's time to put an end on the scanning one so I can get the general updates out of the way.
No, I think we're good for scanning.
Right. Good. Okay, general updates. Like I mentioned, I've attended a few events. I did buy some gear, so I'll go quick. I bought a 50mm lens for my Minolta. So just to give you a perspective, my Minolta body has is my body with the most lens. I have a 28 prime. I have the 50 prime. I have a Sigma 35-105. Yeah, I think it's 35-105. And then I also have a fixed 200mm lens. It's literally four lens, but that's the most I have. So I am really loving the 50. I thought I was a kind of a wide angle person. I like the 28, but I'm enjoying this more normal lens for its focal range. At 50, it's the one on the Minolta for the past few moments. Pretty enjoying that. While I was expecting we would get there, I was not expecting to get there that fast. But since last month, I've had the medium format camera. So I'm starting to be in the medium format. I have bought a Yashicamat 124G. And it's a different type of camera that's called the TLR for twin lens reflex. So you have a viewing lens and a taking lens. It's pretty interesting. It gives you 6x6cm negatives, which means that on the medium format of 120 film roll, you end up with 12 exposure. And I am liking this. To kind of go back to the beginning of this episode, where one, the reason I wanted to do my home scanning is because I really enjoy to have like, I don't know, than 12, but I did a lot of 18 exposure black and white rolls. It's like I felt it was kind of a sweet spot where, oh, I'm in the mood to do black and white on film. Let's go out, do black and white in film, and then poof, 18 frames passes fast. 24-36, excuse me. I always end up, especially at 24, it's like I could do like maybe 10, 15, 18 photos, but then you end up with like kind of, oh crap, I have 6 exposure remaining, but I don't want to burn them, nor do I want to do black and white the next time. So, and worse than that with 36 exposure. So I always like this balance. It's even better or worse, I guess, that depends on which way you see, but for sure with 6x6, it's one of the medium format that gives you, it's the second medium format that gives you the most exposure on a 120 roll. The other one will be 6x4.5, so 6x4.5 centimeters.
Okay, yeah. I was where's the third dimension coming from?
I don't know what's happening with my words tonight.
It's a long week.
Yes. Oh, yes. but 6x5, 6x4x5 is usually nicknamed this way. So you have 6x5, 6x6, 6x7, 6x9, well, 6x8 and 6x9. And 6x9, I think, is 8 exposure per roll of 120. So yeah, it's one day we'll go there because there's a camera. I really want to get there, but we're buying gear again. So, and I'm not there. for fame, I'm really enjoying this different experience. The one weird thing with a TLR is because it's two lens up on one on top of each other, and the one that is called your viewing lens, you don't have a prism. So the way it refracts or reflects light up to you is, first of all, it's a waist level viewfinder, so you look down and the image is flipped. So when you turn left, it shows right, and everything is at light. On the right side, it shows left. So getting used to that mental math is quite interesting. So I'll see what I do. I think, like for example, this weekend we're possibly planning to go apple picking, and I was like, oh, that's gonna be a good camera to just go chill and then go in the trees and then just take a few shots and then not. So I right now really like this as my medium format camera, but it does mean that it complexifies some of the scanning stuff, which I haven't figured out just yet. Like I said, I dropped one of the rolls today, this week, which was one of the 120 rolls. But there's one thing that I liked with 120 is some of the labs here or some of the film store, they still sell Fujifilm Pro 400H, which has been discontinued since 2021. But they still have some in stock, whereas all the 35mm Pro 400H is like either costing an arm and a leg on eBay or just sold out. And from what I've seen, again, I haven't received my roll scanned yet, but from what I've seen on the web, I will really like Pro 400H, so we shall see what happens with medium format. On the topic of liking the colors of certain film stocks, over the summer, I shot two slide film rolls. So one is some Respool Kodak Ektachrome 100D. And during my vacation, the one I was mentioning is a roll of Fuji Prova 100F, which I was lucky to find because this is rare as fuck for this. But I really love the vibrant color of a slide film. Oh boy. Oh boy. But the downside is the processing is a bit more expensive because it involves more chemical, but I think the scanning is a bit simpler because there's no conversion. You just take a photo of the image with the right colors already. You just need to light up your film and hold it correctly. So that was a bit more simpler. The downside of slide film, is its exposure latitude is really, really thin. So I've shot it during the bright sunlight of the Quebec summer. And I was well aware that would happen, but for sure, if you want to have well lit shadows, you end up with a white sky, literally white because it's blown out. I was aware, was playing with it, but I did end up with a few shots that was really like bang on and really excited for that. Compared to color negative, you could burn the sky. Like, it would take a lot of overexposure to burn a color negative because it handles overexposure way better. So, but again, I think generally speaking, people say like color slide film is maybe 4 or 5 stop of difference between your shadows and your highlights before something has to give. Either you have literally dark shadows or black shadows, or you have a white sky because it's overexposed. So, but still, when the light is the same or at the same exposure for most of your frame, the color slide film gives you is oh. I forgot who asked me that recently. Oh, it's another colleague that I haven't seen in a while. I kind of say, hey, I shoot film now. And I was like, yeah, how do you like it so far? Do you have a favorite stock? I'm like, I don't think I have a favorite stock right now, but boy, slide film. Oh, slide film. Oh. And then we kind of geeked out about slide film. But yes. So The downside is, like I said, it's A, more expensive, and B, more expensive to develop. So we shall see. And then, like, I think to give you an example, if I didn't buy this Respool, so they were taking the cinema version of Vector Chrome, which is more or less the same version that we get when we buy it, but still, I think a roll of Vector Chrome right now is between 35 and 40 Canadian dollars. The one I bought Respool was 20, so it's way cheaper, but still compared to other color negative, $20 is kind of close to a lot of the other color negative stuff. Fuji slide film is still around $25-$30, depending on where you can find it, because it's low on stock everywhere on this planet Earth, sadly. So I have a few rolls of these, they're in the fridge, and we'll go slowly through them, but I'm pretty excited to shoot more. Lastly, I discovered that I sucked at Lightroom yet again. And I say that because, remember, I was complaining that I had to apply the color presets from when I shoot digital. I was complaining that in Lightroom CC, I always had to go, like, say I was shooting Fujifilm, I want to apply the film simulation on my RAWs in Lightroom.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I told you there's no way there's not a setting for that.
There is a settings for that. So and when you go in the settings of the app itself, it tells you, oh, when you import RAW, which preset you want to apply. And I think the default one is like Adobe. And then you can say camera or camera settings, which would, if I would have set even on the RAW, let's say in the camera, I would say, oh, I want the Velvia film simulation. For sure, in my RAW, it's not baked in, but it would baked in the file that I told the camera, please use Velvia. So then when you export, when you use the RAW in Lightroom, for example, it knows when you say, please use camera settings, that you wanted to use Velvia. Even if I can change it to Provia, to black and white, the default camera setting would be Velvia in this case, because that was the thing I used in camera. So I've figure out a way to do that. The other thing I was complaining is, now that I've changed the setting to do that, I was like, but why can I not do lens correction too? You can. It's just that Lightroom CC is preset based. So right now, by default, there is a preset that says apply the lens correction. But right, the way the setting, the way the configuration by default is done, is you have to choose either camera settings or lens correction, because lens correction is a preset. So I've quickly looked, I haven't done it, but I looked at the best way, if I want to do both at once, is I have to create my own preset, and then it's just in Lightroom CC settings, just say every time I import RAWs from camera, use my preset. And I felt so dumb because Lightroom CC comes with a shit ton of presets by default. And as I kind of like, I think the way the dropdown is made is you have like Adobe presets, Adobe settings, camera settings, and then presets. And I completely blanked that option of my memory until I've seen this, I think, 6 weeks ago. And I was like, oh crap, I feel dumb. So I haven't done that because I haven't shot too much digital yet, ignoring camera scanning. But yeah, next time I have a shoot or I go out and shoot a lot of digital files, I would like to explore creating my own presets for all the things I want on when I import RAWs in Lightroom. And guess what? It seems I just need to do the work or know how to read the UI for it to work. So that's why I feel dumb. And again, that's why I mean, slowly but surely, the more I use the software, the more I do post-processing, the more I'm kind of associating the right things, like making connection between parts of the knowledge I have about post-processing and making connection, and also taking 3 seconds to read what's written in the software. So
sometimes that's the hardest part.
Yes, it is. So that was the last general update I wanted to mention for today. I hope that you like my discovery of home scanning. And if you are shooting film and you haven't considered doing that, hopefully it makes you interested in the options that are available for you to do so. Again, be prepared to spend money, but I think there are cheap options to do digital camera-based scanning these days, and especially if you plan or if you already are a hybrid shooter, maybe a bit more than I am currently right now when we speak, I think there are really good options to do so. and I hope it makes you curious to explore those.
I think it's really funny that you use the word hybrid shooter, because that's not what that means.
I know. You told me the last time I've said that in the episode, you told me the same thing. And I know. Here, I'll do the correction again, because I forgot to do it before you mentioned it. But here, I mean film and digital, not photo and video.
Yeah, because that's going to be on my episode. Probably.
Who cares about video? Oh, wait, Yannick does.
Yannick does. I do, yeah. Well, yes. If I get my camera in time to actually make the fucking video that I need done by the month of March.
Yes, I was about to say that. Maybe the last update is hopefully in the coming weeks, Yannick will receive his camera and I'll kindly go to his place to steal it from him. No, not steal it, but at least try it for sure.
Yeah, because I didn't mention it in follow-up, my local camera store, when I ordered... I didn't realize that they would be getting like single digit batches of cameras in from Sony. So they are very slowly trickling out the pre-orders. And since I waited like 2 days to pre-order, I'm probably at the tail end of the pre-orders. So I am still waiting on my camera, but I have confirmed that there's nothing wrong with my order. It's just the supply is not there.
Yeah, which... I'll do a quick tangent. Is like Sony just announced new A7C cameras in their lineup. So A7C Mark II and then the A7C R, and they're about to get released. You can already pre-order them, but I think they're getting released in about 2 weeks, give or take. Or no, excuse me, in about a week. I think it's on the 29th. And I'm kind of worried that I wonder if those will be more readily available. And if they are, I'm kind of worried that it's because they reserved production line for those and not for the APS-C bodies like the one you're buying. So hopefully that's not the case. And I think in the end, what will happen is both of them will be like in short supply.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
So,
yeah. And I haven't even watched the A7C revision reviews or read anything about them because I don't want to ruin my new camera already.
I think the TLDR is you're not planning to spend $4,000 on a body, so you can already
definitely not
put an X on the A7CR. But I think on A7II. Maybe the only tempting thing, because it's kind of the same body style, the only temptation would be to have a full frame sensor and 12 more megapixels. I think it's a 33. So knowing that you would be in the APS-C alpha lineup, the body and the usage is similar. So I don't think, and you mentioned multiple times that you don't really care about full frame, like APS-C is totally okay for you.
I know, but I want to live in my bubble and I want to pretend that my new camera is still new. So I'm going to not look at anything about the new cameras until after I get my camera.
That's fair, but I think even if you were to do that right now, I think you'd be like, those bodies were not for me.
Yeah, probably.
Yannick, that is it.
All right. You can find all the show notes for this episode at limitlesspossibility.net/213, or you can find our entire back catalog at limitlesspossibility.net. We are on the Fediverse. The show is on the Fediverse at limipo_podcast@mastodon.social, or you can find us individually. I am at Socarina at icosahedron.website, and Ducardivier is
at luco@mastodon.social.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.